Nous allons avoir, avant la pause, une troisième intervention du professeur Anja Amendtraut de l'Université de Wurzburg. Alors, parmi ses nombreuses qualifications, Madame Amendtraut, et c'est ainsi que je la connais déjà depuis de nombreuses années, elle est présidente de la Société pour les recherches sur la Chambre impériale de justice. Je ne vais pas m'hasarder à donner tout le titre en allemand. Mais là, nous sommes aussi dans le cadre de la recherche vers une culture juridique européenne, dans un véritable laboratoire très important. Cette Chambre impériale de justice a été une institution de juristes qui, par le droit, a malgré tout, dans ce Saint-Empire qui, point de vue politique, est allé de mal en pis, on peut espérer que la construction européenne ira mieux qu'a été la construction de l'Empire au temps moderne, mais que néanmoins, nous avons eu là une institution judiciaire et donc juridique qui a permis, qui a tout de même toujours été un point de focalisation d'une culture juridique largement partagée dans ce Saint-Empire. Et un Saint-Empire qui n'est pas seulement l'Allemagne. N'oublions pas que quand, au XIXe siècle, on a décidé de répartir, de faire éclater toutes les archives de la Chambre impériale de justice, eh bien, on a revu que ça s'est trouvé sur des dizaines et des dizaines de fonds d'archives, pas seulement dans l'Allemagne, mais qu'on les trouve dans plusieurs pays européens. Donc, à cet égard-là aussi, l'expérience, alors ce n'est qu'une des expertises de Madame Amend, qui a surtout aussi beaucoup travaillé sur l'histoire du droit commercial, mais c'est une expérience qui peut être très utile dans notre quête, dans notre recherche vers une culture juridique partagée. Vous avez la parole.
Mesdames et messieurs, chers collègues, c'est un grand plaisir et un grand honneur pour moi d'avoir été invité à présenter une conférence à la Collège de France. Je vous remercie beaucoup pour votre invitation. Our domestic law is an endless mess of antagonistic, destructive, and spotted regulations, totally disposed to separate the Germans from each other and to deter the judges and lawyers from in-depth knowledge of the law. But even full knowledge of this chaotic potpourri does not get you any further, because our whole domestic law is so incomplete and empty that from 100 questions, at least 90 should be decided by received external codes, namely canon law and Roman law. Here in particular, the adversity is peaking. That's how Anton Friedrich Justus Thibaut described the state of civil law in Germany at the beginning of the 19th century, a conflict situation clearly showing the distinct legal cultural diversity within the empire. Based thereon, one ends up wondering how any legal culture commonalities can be found in the European context. The search for traces focuses on the normative emphasis of a common jus commune for the European legal sphere, which was paving the way for a continental European civil law through incorporation of Roman law and canon law. Although they are closely interlinked and have a common normative space, the three fields of institutional traditions, such as legal education and court structure, scientific dogmatic discourse of private law and legal practice, may not to be subsumed too soon, but rather should be considered separately. While all these three sub-areas present facets of a legal culture consisting of the mentioned elements, an independent development is conceivable. Applied to the search for European legal culture, this means the necessity to compare legal education, scientific processing, and ways of finding justice. This reveals that a comparative finding of justice is suitable as well as necessary to constitute a European legal culture after all, regardless of the difficulties to contrast a limited number of comparison parameters and an undetermined number of regularities or even relationships. Furthermore, such a comparative legal culture is also implementable for the chosen focus by means of abundant source material, which is surely important to withdraw from the theoretical approach. Before focusing on that, a few quick comments on legal education and scientific debate are to be mentioned first. Regarding legal education, the Institutionenvorlesung, institution lecture, introduced law to large parts of Europe. Textbooks designed by authors such as Vinius or Heinexius were used throughout Europe. The lawyers of the Holy Roman Empire were also at first, almost without exception, educated in terms of jus commune. The particular law, on the other hand, was not included in academic education. Only from the 17th century on, the lecture activities at the universities gradually began to change, not through state interference, but due to the changing scientific horizon. The very first lectures on natural law, which are represented by authors such as Hugo Grotius, Samuel von Pufendorf, Christian Thomasius and Christian Wolff, were followed by lectures on German law, occasionally also resulted in the first chairs for these new fields. In scientific discourse, the jus commune established the common object of the European jurisprudence. In this context, Franz Wiacker was talking of the pan-European common law per se. Helmut Koehn describes the jurisprudence of the medieval period as a European discipline. Here, the Roman law embodied the reason of the law and constituted the natural universal grammar of the law. The significance of Roman law is again emphasized by the fact that its grammar in use even when applying jus proprium, meaning the particular law. The question of the extent to which Roman law found its way into legal practice had already been a key issue in the academic debate as early as in the 17th century in the Holy Roman Empire, where local law was sporadically used in the educated jurisprudence. In the second half of the 17th century, there were works published in the Holy Roman Empire handling the respective court practice in detail within the framework of the presentation of jus commune, thereby striving for scientific integration of actually applicable law. In these works, Roman law represented only one part of the positive law, but had certainly been the central role. The unitary European jus commune was replaced by a whole string of national common legal systems. For example, the so-called jus romano saxonum, jus romano germanicum, jus romano hispanicum, and so on. Therefore, for the field of academic debate, jus commune law, offered a joint starting point from which special paths were broken by means for particular influences. A good impression of these special paths is given by the legal map published 1896 on the occasion of the enactment of the German Civil Code, Bürgerliches Gesetzbuch, displaying only the most important particular laws, including several municipal laws, which became redundant upon introduction to the civil code, here identified in color. Thibault comments the academic controversy about the particular law in his pamphlet from 1814 that, I quote, "Hitherto there had been a black night over the particular law in terms of science." A similar pluralistic constellation also applied to wide areas of the legal practice. Indeed, Roman and canon law displayed the so-called communis opinio across borders, conveyed through the universally used Latin language, and constituted a common basis for the scholarly jurisdiction to a great extent, even in the Middle Ages. Yet, during these times, the scholarly jurisdiction was only a small part of the legal practice, since scholarly lawyers had been primarily deployed in the pastoral jurisdiction since the 12th century. Only from the 15th century on, with the advent of the supreme jurisdiction, they had also been active in higher courts. Also concerning the theoretical concept of the application of law at the highest courts in the Holy Roman Empire, a united authority of common law is supposed, which is, however, increasingly shattered by centrifugal factors, such as the development of territorial dominions and the consideration of domestic laws. Which law had to be applied at the two highest courts in the Holy Roman Empire, the Reichskammergericht, Imperial Chamber Court, and the Reichshofrat, Aulic Council, was distinctively settled in 1495, for the first time by means of the procedural order of the Imperial Chamber Court. Article 3 provided for the judges at the Imperial Chamber Court to be sworn into judging per the common law of the empire and only as far as they were brought by them also the particular law and the customary law of the principalities and the dominions. Thus, common law was assumed to be known by the courts and its application was surmised. On the other hand, the validity of particular legal regulations had to be put forth and proven by the parties. The principle, the court knows law, das Gericht kennt das Recht, had therefore not applied to particular law. This was due to the consideration of the judges at the Imperial Chamber Court, who in their university education at first only encountered jus commune and originated from the most diverse territories. Therefore, they were not expected to know the actual diverse particular legal systems. So in contrast to the medieval legal source hierarchy, Rechtsquellenhierarchie, which according to particular law etched out common law at the supreme jurisdiction level, the particular law, at least normatively, played a minor role. This kind of normatively described principle of application of law in the Holy Roman Empire created the conditions for the nationwide dissemination of Roman law and is possibly offering comparative parameters for the search of a common European legal culture. Therefore, especially the supreme jurisdiction is suitable for contributing to unification of laws. Based thereon, the further way For a common legal culture with Roman canonic roots developing across the borders of the empire had been paved. The hereby created preferred position of Roman law was rather motivated by the conviction of the rationality and superiority of Roman law instead of a constitutional claim to power through the emperor for nationwide applicable law or a claim to power in terms of legal policy by juridical elites. In contrast, the reinforcement of the particular law resulting from a monarch's order certainly meant the reinforcement of the territorial political claim to power. The general interest of the territorial authorities was rather to enact their own normative orders than to rely on the Roman legal application of law. To do so, single territories obtained a series of appellation privileges, Appellationsprivilegien, which prevented a move of proceedings to one of the highest courts of the empire, and by this consolidated the territorial jurisdiction and consolidated also the local law within the territories. The so-called Golden Bull from 1356, a decree issued by the Imperial Diet at Nuremberg and Metz, fixed for a period for more than 400 years important aspects of the constitutional structure of the Holy Roman Empire. This Golden Bull had already, for the first time, confirmed or allowed the privilegium de non appellando illimitatum to the electors. In particular, in the early modern period, more and more imperial estates obtained appellation privileges, mostly in case of certain matters in dispute, for example, sales transactions, as you can see here, the privilegia de non appellando granted in March 1508 to the city of Nuremberg, or until achieving a certain sum of complaint, which were developed further in the course of time. To be granted such privileges, it was appropriate to request the Imperial Aulic Council for issuing of the according privileges. So even through German jurisdiction from the end of the Middle Ages until 1806 was generally shaped by the present supreme jurisdiction of the German Empire. Many imperial estates had been successfully striving for partial or complete sovereignty of their own jurisdiction since 1495. Until the middle of the 17th century, almost all larger imperial estates had snapped up such privileges. Once privileged in such a way, there was generally no chance for legal action to a highest court. Among other things, through the expansion of an independent judicial system, the territorial sovereigns were hence able to strengthen their ruling power towards imperial claim to power. But exactly this impeded the further development of a unifying legal culture within the empire, or even the development of a European legal culture. This pluralistic tendency was reinforced by the fact that single parts of the empire were, for their part, bound to partly overlapping particular legal systems. The aristocracy was bound to the respective territorial feudal laws, craftsmen to the bylaws of their municipal guilds, monks to the rules of their brotherhoods. The church courts declared their responsibilities for causae spirituales. The diversity of law and courts enhanced the centrifugal efforts within the empire. Among these constitutional and legal aspects which were already worked against a legal entity within the Holy Roman Empire, and above all regarding a European dimension, former studies have recently proven that the particular law was of major importance even in legal practice at the highest courts in the Holy Roman Empire. This clarifies that the academical educated lawyers surely had knowledge of single particular laws and applied it, even if its validity had not been proven by the parties. Consequently, the highest court jurisdiction did not function as harmoniously as had been ascribed to, especially regarding to the Roman law. With respect to their unequal status in the proceedings, the party representatives, anyhow more frequently referred to the particular laws than the judges. Considering the records of the highest courts of the Holy Roman Empire reveals that lawyers referred to text passages of the Juris Civilis, but the particular laws and relevant literature were at least equally used to reinforce a legal argument. These aspects indicate that also with respect to substantive law, which was applied in the legal practice at the highest courts, it cannot automatically be assumed that a European legal culture had existed since the early modern period. This is, of course, different in case of procedural law, commonly orientated towards the Roman law model. Surely, all this is no general claim only applicable within the Holy Roman Empire. Also in other countries, during the nation building, especially in France, the application of Roman law had been pushed back generally in favor of domestic law. However, I would like to put forward the thesis that in any case there was a cross-national, possibly also an European, legal culture at the process of finding justice, namely in the field of commercial law. It had been established by practice and then adapted into regulatory law, or it failed to a lack of practicability or efficiency. Commercial law represents a subject which had developed over a long period, largely isolated from academic opinions or even legislative measures, and was instead the law of the merchants, masterminded by their interests. This includes especially company law, exchange law, and bankruptcy law. For many queries of the traders arising from the performance of their activities, Roman law, being the handed-down basis of a common legal culture, barely offered satisfying solutions or no solutions at all, despite the valid common civil norms, which of course also applied to commercial law, for example, those norms referring to legal capacity or contract law. Instruments like the bill of exchange or the trading company, in their diverse varieties, enabling and advancing transregional trade or even international trade, rather originated from the practical application, namely the medieval Italian, and therefore from impulses by the merchants themselves. Only upon applying and using these kinds of methods in the mercantile daily business, legal problems also emerged, awaiting a solution. Here it becomes evident that in the Holy Roman Empire, the merchants not only made use of academically educated lawyers, but also relied on the recommendations of experienced colleagues. For clarifying legal issues, it was customary to first ask the advice of experienced merchants. These so-called pares were produced usually in case of a controversy. By means of them, a controversial issue could be settled without being bound to rigid procedural rules. However, often they also formed the basis for legal decisions, either after the parties had handed in expert opinions as evidence to the files during the proceedings, as you can see here, or in case the court itself had asked for such an expert opinion. Either way, the courts gratefully received them, mainly due to the lack of their own expertise. This applies especially to disputes for which the available particular law or the common law did not offer any solution, but at the same time being part of the everyday business of the commercial practice. Textbooks dealing, for example, with exchange law even emphasize the quality of the expert opinions as a guiding principle accordingly for the judge. Therefore, the pares did not only find confirmation among the merchants themselves, but also lower courts, and even the Imperial Chamber Court referred to the contents if proceedings were brought to it. Its decisions were held in high regard, as for example by contemporary jurisprudents such as Hermann Kunring, who, referring to the Würzburg Council, stated that decisions of the Imperial Chamber Court would be treated by local lower courts just like written laws. The now established opinion, which is also supported by our honored host, stating that jus commune was offering a conceptual framework for lawyers' practice, may at the current state of research be extended to merchants who produced expert opinions. As outwardly recognizable, these expert opinions follow in their structure the tradition of the medieval ages and the early modern period, finding their roots in the procedural law of the jus commune. Also, the content follows the common argumentation practiced in courts referring to the jus commune. In this course, its procedural or rather substantive legal aspects were often taken as a basis for more specific legal questions for which a trade-orientated modification was needed. Furthermore, the pares were likewise confirmed in the juridic and mercantile literature and were taken into consideration. Collections of the pares were published in printed handbooks about trading practice or statute books. Due to this diverse process of reception concerning the pares, originally not being normative, law was established, namely law which was not created authoritatively by an authoritarian legislator. Indeed, the legislator itself significantly made use of these achievements and hence adopted them into laws, often with the assistance of representatives of the merchant profession. Here, it is worth mentioning, for example, the particular legal exchange laws, or rather the national drafts, the most important of which served as a basis for the German exchange law from 1848 or the German commercial code from 1861. Its memorandum said that the intention was to, I quote, bring that into legal norms which is already established as law in the mind of the merchant's profession. The basis for enacting a commercial law should consequently be the law of a single state, but also commercial habits. It is remarkable that the described development of finding justice in commercial issues and its legislative process is not unique for the Holy Roman Empire. Something similar can be observed, for example, for France. These observations disclose major similarities in the field of commercial law, which can be made until the coming into force of the first codifications regarding commercial law. Merchants often did not primarily seek justice in ordinary courts. Rather, expert opinions were furnished by mercantile communities of large commercial centers such as Nuremberg, Hamburg, Leipzig, but also Lyon, London, Antwerp, or Bautzen. These replaced an authoritative dictum by effecting for the merchant's trading what would be solved in other cases by responsa, juris, and prudentum. The disputes of the mercantile everyday business which were dealt with were often similar or even equivalent, no matter whether the merchant was of French, Italian, German origin, or of a different nationality. Not coincidentally, English new creations, or rather modifications, penetrated the commercial practice across the water, as, for example, the cheque, loan against ships, or changes in the field of company law or maritime law. And the starting point was similar. Written common law, as well as particular law, often did not offer sufficient solutions in case of controversies. It is this kind of synchronism which had already led Gérard de Malines, English trader and mercantilist, back in the 20s of the 16th century, to ponder about the existence of a lex mercatoria in his book with the same title, an idea being intensively discussed until today and having been well suited for achieving a status of a relational common law in its particular field. Due to these parallels, the expert opinion circulated among the merchants cross borders and thus shaped a common, not only practical commercial understanding, but also a collective commercial law understanding. The reception of the expert opinions into relevant literature, amongst others such as the works of Johannes Marquardt or Jacques Savary, who, by the way, all used the standard works of Sigismund Scaccia or Benvenuto Stracca, reinforced the development on this peculiar shape of legal culture and was further enhanced by its reception of later authors and ordinary courts. Like the mentioned German exchange law and German commercial law, for the history of origins of the Ordonnance de Commerce of 1673, the consideration of the established trading habits, which were received in the described way, is significant. Here, the trading people also contributed to its development. Summing up, these thoughts reveals that taking a common legal culture for granted falls short, simply because almost everywhere a kind of reception of the Roman law had taken place. This finding could at best be tenable for a static snapshot, disregarding the special domestic path in general, and in particular, that latest since the early modern times, Roman law had in practice neither been fully applicable in the Holy Roman Empire nor in France. From this period on, parallels can at best be demonstrated in the field of commerce. Additional research amongst the here mentioned countries, Germany and France, would probably bring to light even more correlations with other parts of Europe. There is a manageable legislative basis for the common commerce which has developed since the Middle Ages. Controversies are solved by a diverse expert task which circulated in relevant literature and then became a decision basis for the judicature, which was then taken over by judicative or a doctrine, and finally led to legislative measures, German exchange law and commercial law, Code de commerce, for example. However, it should be noted that searching for traces of a common legal culture is presumably more successful in the field of commercial law than in other fields, since commercial law moves more easily across political and cultural borders than other legal matters. In the light of these thoughts, the evaluation of a Dutch commercial law expert of the 19th century about the importance of comparative legislation for commercial law might be understood. Accordingly, its cosmopolitan nature was forcing, I quote, all nations to participate in the movement occurring in this field. The same might apply for Roman law, only to a limited extent. Now, in the light of the crisis of law, something seems to repeat itself. Although the past process arose from the developing legal culture itself, and the present process extraneously is encroaching legal culture. Once before, with a view to jus communis, the historical experience of a legal unity was said to be completed. And even in a new millennium, the sailing ship flying the flags of a Europe growing together until a few years ago, and the related efforts for unification of law 60 years after signing the Roman contracts could shipwreck. Je vous remercie de votre attention.
Merci beaucoup, Anja Ament, pour cette excellente vue de ce qui s'est passé dans ce, surtout dans le Saint-Empire, avec beaucoup d'échos de thèmes que j'ai déjà abordés dans mes propres leçons dans le cadre de cette chaire européenne. Je me suis même dit que quand vous avez abordé la question de la Lex Mercatoria, que je n'avais peut-être pas autant triché que je l'ai dit dans ma leçon inaugurale, en prenant ça comme une sorte de fer de lance de ce qu'a pu être une culture juridique européenne. Alors, je regrette beaucoup, mais vu les contraintes que nous avons et vu l'heure, je vais reporter la discussion qui était prévue maintenant à la fin de la journée. Donc, on a encore pour ce matin deux autres interventions. Nous allons faire une pause maintenant et la discussion, sinon ça va nous mener trop loin, la discussion ce que nous aurons, j'espère, donc en fin de matinée, portera alors sur les cinq interventions de ce matin. Alors, nous allons nous retrouver ici à 11h30, alors très strictement, et entre-temps j'invite les intervenants, aussi bien les intervenants de ce matin que les intervenants de cet après-midi, de me joindre pour la pause. Je vous remercie.